Look, I was working here as the general manager of landside operations at the time, and the port was in a fair bit of prominence in relation to a number of environmental issues around mineral exports we were doing at the time, copper concentrate and iron ore. And there'd been reports of copper concentrate being spilled into the harbour. That led to a lot of media coverage and a lot of public comment around what was happening. And as a result, the CEO at the time was removed from the position, and I found myself acting as a CEO.
So this would have been quite sudden for you, was it?
Yeah,
All of a
it
sudden,
was.
you were the boss.
Yeah, well, it was a bit sudden. It certainly wasn't where I had expected to be at the beginning of that day, you might say. But the reality is, my trajectory was always, from my perspective, was about becoming CEO of a port. That's where my academic study and all of my previous experience had been sort of based around port management, realistically.
So 2008, remind us again, what are the big commodities, the big customers for Darwin Port back then?
Obviously, Territory Resources and the Francis Creek mine going out of there, and we did about 2.5 million tonnes in 2008, 2009. OM Manganese was coming out of Bootu Creek, and around 1 million tonnes of that was coming out. We're doing copper concentrate for OZ Minerals out of Prominent Hill. We were also obviously doing live cattle containers, but we were on the cusp, if you like, of then some of the exploration work around the development of the oil and gas fields, which we're living with today.
The arrival of INPEX, a multi-billion dollar project, the biggest the territory's ever seen. What was that like for you here at the port?
Yeah, look, it's been a long journey, and as I clean out my office, I'm finding things which date back over 10 years in relation to meetings we attended 10 years ago, where INPEX first came to Darwin to talk about a option to use Darwin as the development of that process. I was fortunate enough, I sat within a number of government committees at the time, the Oil and Gas Committee, major projects, etc. So in all those forums, the development of INPEX was foremost. For the port, though, it was actually we spent a lot of money on staff going to places like Japan, doing modelling and simulation to see whether it was feasible to bring those LNG tankers in here, where the best spot to put the LNG tankers was going to be. There was always about how we would cope with the construction, rock loadouts, the pipeline coming through the port. There was a lot of different facets of the interaction around bringing that project to Darwin.
And at the height of the project, tell me about the competition for berth at the wharf. I mean, how tight did it get?
Yeah, look, I mean, when ports talk about being full, we talk about anything over 60% berth utilisation means you've got ships in the queue. And when you get to that point, you've got to think, what do we do next and how long is that going to last for? We operated through a period of about 18 months to 2 years there where the occupancy was around 80 to 85%.
Wow.
So having ships in the queue wasn't unusual. From our perspective, there was a lot of competing parts to that, if you like, and amongst those is live cattle. We always have the welfare issue of live cattle and getting them on the berths, getting them loaded and getting them out. So superimposing that on the requirements around dredging operations, laying the pipe in the port, as well as the bulk mineral exports. We'd been through the GFC, so at this stage we're also trying to make sure that those mineral exporters actually were viable. So getting their product out was pretty important too. So there was a lot of balls in the air, and took a lot of fairly hands-on management to make it all happen.
You happy with how the port managed through that period?
Yeah, look, I exceptionally pleased. The reality is, while some people had to wait, most things happened on time, and we were able to utilise the facilities that we had pretty well. We call it about sweating the asset, and the asset was sweating a lot over that period of time, trust me.
And I heard from one of your colleagues the other day that when it comes to berths, you're operating at about 30% now, so there's been that real come down. Has that meant jobs have been lost?
In the port, not so much, but certainly in the stevedoring part of the world, the number of staff has reduced. And in some other parts that facilitate activities around the port, there's been a reduction in staff. On the other side of the coin, though, we've seen the berth utilisation from the oil and gas rise considerably over the last couple of years. So that's been a bit of an offset. Cattle have been good for us, but certainly general cargo, break bulk, and all those are certainly down. And the only bulk product that we do in any real scale now is the OM manganese. And we're seeing some of the, you know, mineral sands go out as well, but not in the bulk numbers that we saw before.
If you're just tuning in, this is the Country Hour, and we're speaking to Terry O'Connor, the outgoing chief executive of the Darwin Port. He's been in the top gig for 11 years now. 2011, Terry, the snap decision by the federal government to ban the live export trade to Indonesia. What was that like for you?
Look, it was really interesting. I actually had been to the AGM of the Live Exporters Association meeting here in Darwin about a week beforehand, where this was raised as a possibility, and particularly what was happening with the Four Corners tapes at the time. For us, it was a real sit-back moment. We sort of looked at what it meant and what it might mean, and obviously no cattle through here for over 3 months was a bit of a hit for us. The reality, however, is that when you looked at our numbers for the 12 months, we didn't lose any numbers because they certainly put a lot of cattle back out through here fairly quickly. For us, though, it probably made us sit back and talk about what would happen if the live cattle industry did go completely. And that saw us make decisions about construction of refrigerated container points, certainly with working with AACo at the time around what that might mean. And look, we put in infrastructure for 200, but today we can expand that to 2,000 if required. So box beef, if live cattle does start, we think box beef is still going to be a part. But today, live cattle is really important to the port, and we continue to work with the live cattle exporters to make it happen. I mean, our biggest year was 2014 with over 600,000 head exported through the port. So we still see the live cattle as a very big, important part of the business.
Is that day in particular sort of burnt into your brain? Because from memory, there was sort of trucks stuck on the wharf. There was helicopters flying over with media getting pictures. It was full on.
Yeah, look, it is. I suppose I've had a lot of burnt into my mind moments over the last 10 years. And certainly that was one that sticks in my mind. And I think the reason it sticks in my mind was that very animated discussion that happened at that meeting about a week beforehand, and I came back to the port after that meeting saying this could be real. You know, we probably expected some sort of lead time, but when it sort of happened almost overnight, that was fairly impressive from our perspective in that, you know, we had to do a lot of things quickly, and you're right, there were cattle on ships and there were ships already sailing and there was all sorts of things happening which needed to be undone, if you like. But, you know, but at the same time, you know, the GFC, if you like, was another overnight instantaneous front page, and certainly the port lease was another instantaneous front page. There's been a number of instantaneous front pages over that period of time.
All of a sudden, the port's got new owners, new managers, Lambidge Group from China. Grabbed headlines all over the world. What was it like for you as the chief executive?
Yeah, look, really interesting. I had certainly sat on the side of the government when the lease process was running, and I was there when Lambridge got to the final three, and at that stage I was excised from the selection process. So I had an anticipation that once Lambridge took over, I thought I would go.
Right.
That was my natural expectation. It seemed to be the way of port businesses that private ownership came in, and the first thing they did was put a new head into the seat. I was pretty fortunate, I think, to a certain degree in that Lambridge offered me the option to stay on for 6 months. Here I am 4 years later, and I'm still here. So they asked me to stay on, and for me it was really, I looked at that as a real challenge, transitioning from what was a government business division to a commercial operation, and bringing not only the staff along for the ride, but certainly the many customers and contractors that we deal with on a daily basis, and bringing them along for the ride, if you like, for the transformation.
The decision got heavily criticised. Some analysts called it a dumb decision. What have you seen, though, here at ground level?
For me, I was, as I said, I was part of the government, and I understood why government had moved through that. I stand here quite openly and say I've stood beside four prime ministers at various parts of the port as they've talked about what they were going to do for the port, from $350 million investments to $50 million investments, NAIF funding. We've seen them all, both sides of Parliament. None of that, not one cent of that has come through. Ports need real money invested into it. It needs the ability to be really flexible in how it delivers service. It needs a long-term vision on delivering that. What private ownership and certainly the Landbridge Group have bought is a willingness to invest, but invest on business grounds. It's got to have a reason to do it. It's got to have a business return to do it. And so it brings a real simplicity to the function that enables us to expand and to do things. When we're in government, we're often beholden to government policies and often beholden to what was on the front page of the paper driving those policies. That doesn't exist anymore.
It's a 99-year lease. What do you think the Darwin port looks like in the year 2100?
Look, we've just been through a 50-year master planning exercise.
Okay, what does it look like in 50 years then?
Well, what we see now, of course, is two things. Much bigger ships. So the movement to much bigger ships is well and truly entrenched and underway. How much bigger are they going to get? I don't know. You know, the Panama Canal has now gone to 400 metres long. So, you know, right now everything's 399.7 metres, I think, is the number they tend to work at for anything that's going to go through the lock area. And that seems to be the stopgap at the moment. The other real thing that we see is automation. We've seen it already in containerised ports going through that automation process now. And that's very real in those unloading and loading of container vessels. We're seeing things like tug operations now being trialled, automation. We're seeing, actually only a reading yesterday in Japan where they're trialling a process where vessels berth and unberth completely automated as well. So I think what you're going to see is in 20 years' time that there will be a lot less human interference, if you like, in the way ships are managed and getting them onto berth and getting them unloaded. But I think at the other side of that, we're going to see a lot of jobs around repairing the equipment, operating the stuff, because the stuff breaks. If it's mechanical, it breaks. I've got a son who's a diesel fitter, and he works over in the mines in Western Australia, and he fixes the big trucks, which don't have any drivers, but the diesel engines and things still break. So those sort of maintenance tasks are still going to happen. What won't happen, of course, is that we will have a lot less risk of injury, and certainly the human factor which causes some of the accidents and incidents to occur will actually be negated as well. So,
are you tipping any commodities to really take off in the next 50 years?
Look, there are a number of things that we've always talked about in the port. Phosphate, we think, is a real product out of the Northern Territory in the future. I sit down there, there's a piece of sandalwood sitting down there. I think, again, sandalwood is a bit of a thing for the port in the future, and we certainly talk regularly to the operators of that particular product at the moment. We've seen the broadacre farming with interest. We've certainly been over to Kununurra and looked at the cotton and what that might mean. I heard this morning talk about aquaculture and, you know, sea dragon and sea farms is very real for us, and we think that's real for the future. But I do believe the climate here will see the things broadacre. Now, whether it's sorghum, whether it's soybean or whatever it might be, I think that will be what we'll see in Northern Australia in 30 or 40 years' time.
Have you got a memorable day, moment, quirky story you can share with us? The sort of story that you would have gone home and said, you won't believe what happened to me today. Have you got something for us?
Look, I could tell you lots of quirky stories. I think probably one of the weirdest ones, if you like, is that I'd been through a number of visits of various people that had come to Darwin. And, you know, I got one phone call on a Saturday morning saying there's a US gentleman wants to come and see you at the port, and he happened to be the Secretary of Navy. And anyway, we went through a lot of what that might mean. Anyway, within 1 week, and it was about a week after I joined became permanently appointed as a CEO, I was invited to a function in Melbourne. So I quickly went to the opening of Parliament here, met the Governor-General, Quinton Bryce at the time, got in a plane, flew to Melbourne, and it was a function for Princess Mary of Denmark. So Princess Mary of Denmark, got in the plane, flew back here, and then invited, as I was, to President Obama here in the hangar at the RAF base. And I thought after that week, this is a pretty interesting gig.
Wow.
that I'm meeting some fairly, well, I won't say meeting, but certainly I was being with some very influential people at the time. So I think for me that was probably marked what the rest of the time was going to be.
And, have you got photos? You got selfies of you with them?
No, I don't have them. In those days, you've got to remember, 11 years ago, well, you know.
Yeah, we weren't taking selfies and stuff, were we?
iPhones were relatively new at the time. In fact, I don't think even iPhones were around when I took over here at the port. But yeah, 2011, they were around. But certainly selfies weren't one of those things that you did when on those occasions, especially.
Where to next for Terry O'Connor?
Look, I'm off on holidays next week, over to Europe. I actually am a bit of a push bike rider, so I'm off to see the end of the Tour de France, and from there I'll then get in a push bike and ride around France for the next month after that, and then I'll come back and make a decision where I go next from there. So no decisions. At one stage I thought I'd retire, but everyone tells me I'm too young to retire.
All the best. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Matt. Cheers.